Welcome to the Weekly Juice Podcast, where we discuss all things real estate, personal finance, investing, and entrepreneurship. Whether this is your first time here or you're an avid listener, we're thrilled to have you a part of our community. Our goal is to share successful stories of entrepreneurs and investors in the hopes that these stories inspire you along your journey towards financial freedom. We discuss successes, failures, systems, motivations, experiences, and key lessons learned over time. After each episode, you should feel motivated, empowered, and prepared to take action in your own life. Make sure to tune in every Wednesday to get your weekly juice. You can also find us on Instagram at Weekly Juice Pod, where we post daily content, personal finance tips, and document our own journey towards financial freedom. This episode is sponsored by Rent Ready. Are you looking for an affordable property management software to help you manage your rental portfolio? Check out our partner, Rent Ready. They help us market and list properties, screen tenants, collect rent, manage maintenance, and maintain leases. You can visit their website at www.rentredi.com and use our code JUICEPOD. That's JUICEPOD for 50% off any plan. Get started today. Welcome back to the Weekly Juice. As always, it's your boys, Ryan and Corey, here with another episode for you. Today, we had on a very special guest, Michael Elefante. He is a 29-year-old real estate investor, specifically focused on short-term rentals. And he's going to generate just about $1 million in revenue this year with 6 properties, which is absolutely insane. He invests in 3 different markets. But just hearing his story, he and his wife, 3 years ago, he was working at Dunkin' Donuts. She was working at Domino's, making $7 and $10 an hour to going just about to $1 million a year is absolutely insane. He's also documented his journey on social media, and he's skyrocketed on TikTok up to 730,000 followers.
Yeah.
Has a course out teaching people how to be successful at Airbnb. Just like the guy's got it going on, and just an incredible story from zero to hero.
Yeah. Yeah. The cool thing is he was talking about how his wife's due in the next couple of months. He's going to have all this time to be able to spend. He spends like a couple hours a week working on his Airbnb business. And
he talks all about his time freedom. I think that's the most important thing, is just like, I'm now no longer trading my time for money to go work for a typical 9-to-5 job where my money's working for me. And now I'm going to be able to spend time doing the things that I want. And he's super excited for his kid. And it's just going to be an exciting time for him coming up in the next couple of years, because now he doesn't have to go work for someone else in order to get paid. He's going to manage his Airbnbs for a couple hours a week.
Michael's the guy who runs the properties that you're renting out for your bachelor or bachelorette parties with like the murals and stuff. And he dives into like all the psychology behind this and how some of these properties are actually generating significantly more than next door neighbors with the same floor plan based on like how he's designed them. So it's a detailed episode on like how he runs his business and how in 3 years he's grown this small but mighty portfolio that generates a ton of cash flow. So without further ado, I think we should bring him in.
Let's do it. Michael, officially welcome to the show. Corey and I are thrilled to have you on, and we can't wait to share your story with our listeners.
Yeah, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm super pumped.
Absolutely. So if you could give a little background on yourself, who you are, where you're from, and then how you got into real estate investing.
Yeah. So I grew up in North Carolina. I grew up an athlete, and that was like what my days were centered around, mainly baseball, especially going into college. But once my college career came to a screaming halt, I was hoping to play pro ball. Didn't pan out. So I didn't really know what to do. Like a lot of people really leaving college, honestly. Right. So I applied for a bunch of jobs, and actually ended up deciding to come back for a 5th year. But before then I was working at a startup. This is back in 2015, a startup tech sales company, called Who Looks Medical, which is definitely like a major HIPAA compliance issue, but they basically put cameras in waiting rooms to kind of like promote advertising based on like who was looking. So super weird product, made $0. So I was just trying to make some money through that summer while I was figuring out if I was going to come back for 5th year or not. The only company that would hire me was Dunkin' Donuts. I went to interviews at multiple restaurants. I had restaurant experience. So I was just looking to like wait tables. I applied for some internships. Nothing panned out. I even made it to the final interview for Chipotle, and they picked some high schoolers over me. And I had a finance degree from Elon University. So I was like, man, that's tough. So anyways, it's kind of funny. Hindsight 2020, I was making like $7.25 an hour, work at pouring coffees. I was waking up like 5 a.m. Just to put gas in the car and whatnot. So I went back for a 5th year. After that, I got a tech sales job. Had no idea what I was doing. I was just eager to learn, eager to make some money and see how life would kind of pan out. Pounded the phones, like 70 to 100 cold calls a day, trying to sell products I really didn't truthfully know that much about. Like a lot of people, you know, you kind of fall into that grind. So I was just like, let me work up the corporate ladder, get an inside sales, outside sales, and then I'll be happy, right? I'll make more money. I'll be happy. Quickly come to find out, fast forward a couple of years, I started to make a lot more money each year and I worked hard, but I was like, man, my, you know, I start to trade more time for that money. So it's like, that's not financial freedom. I started to learn about that term, financial freedom, financial independence, started to read books like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, watch a ton of YouTube, learned that a lot of wealthy people stop trading time for money and they start making their money go work for them, right? Through investments or through businesses they create. So a lot of people read about that and dive into real estate. So that's what got me interested in real estate several years ago, probably around 2017. And like a lot of people, right, do house hacking, do duplexes, whatever, single family, small multifamily, $200 a door until you get to financial freedom. And that was really tough for me to consume because I started to do the math. I'm like, how many down payments do I have to make? How many deals do I have to do or broker to get to that number per month, the cash flow that would enable me to leave this job that I really just hated every day. Then I stumbled upon Airbnb and short-term rentals. When I moved to Nashville in 2018, my wife and I started to look into this. My neighbor actually worked for a property management company. So I started to ask them a bunch of questions around nightly rates and occupancy. And I just built a spreadsheet. I'm like, if these numbers are real, I'm all in. And why isn't everyone else doing this? Like, why would you even bother investing in other things? Because the return is significant. And a single property can honestly set you financially free, which is what I found out. So we were all in. I actually sold my truck, which was like a super souped up GMC Sierra that I loved dearly, just finished paying off, sold that so I could actually have enough money to furnish the first property because we didn't have enough money. That property started cash flowing thousands a month. We liquidated our retirement accounts to buy the second one, 401k IRAs, pretty much down to zero. So I say all in, I meant all in. Yeah. Got a second one, fast forward, saved up some cash flow, money from work, got a third, partnered on our fourth deal, which we can get into all these deals if you guys want later. I don't want to burn too much time at the beginning, but now where we're at today, my wife and I quit our jobs officially in April of 2020, traveled for a year in a camper van managing our Airbnbs, started doing a bunch of content online, just kind of sharing these experiences, sharing knowledge around short-term rentals, what I was learning, what worked for us, how it worked for other people. The four properties we had up and running were cash flowing 27 to 30,000 a month-ish. And we are about to launch two more. I was actually working on a listing today for our
27. Hold on, 2,700 to 3,000 a month. Is that what you're saying?
27,000
cash.
30,000 cash.
Oh, okay. For all four of them
total.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah. Right. It's crazy when you're talking short-term rentals. I'm not joking. A single property can cash flow thousands per month. We've had months where a single property, and these are some of them are larger, right? Have done 29,000 in cash flow for a single month. I mean, that is insane to me. I was like, this is not real life that I'm living in. But again, we can kind of carve into how we figured out like a cool formula for that. But we're about to launch two more, which will probably get us to 45 to 50 grand a month in cash flow. And it's just really cool to see how quickly this can happen for somebody who is literally working at Dunkin' Donuts. By the way, my wife worked at Domino's, so she was making like 10 bucks an hour, the big dough, no pun intended. But I'll pause there.
That's a good one. Pun intended. I like that. Wow. Making the big dough, 10 bucks an hour, between 7 and 10 bucks an hour to potentially $1 million a year just off of six short-term rentals. And just, it's just mind-blowing to me. Can you even imagine talking about these numbers 3 years ago and just conceptualizing where you'd be at? It's wild.
No, not at all.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the short-term rentals and where specifically you were finding them, because I think that, you know, there's some relevance here in the past couple of years to what's the right market to look in. Maybe not the right one, but the right one for you. Where are you buying these and where do you continue to buy these short-term rentals?
So the first two we bought were in Nashville, Tennessee, and it was an easy segue because we had just moved from Texas to Nashville. Nashville is a huge bachelorette yep. party city, right? And a ton of just growing foot traffic with all the music scene and all that stuff. So really fun city to visit. And I saw the flood of people there every weekend. I mean, you go down Broadway, which is like the main strip with all the bars, and you'll see 50 tiaras and, you know, bride to be satchels and whatever you call them. So I'm like, this is crazy. I was like, where are they staying? Like, is it hotels? But they have big groups, 10 to 15 people. Like, they're staying in Airbnbs. Like, how much are they paying per night? Right. So that's when I was like, if we can kind of create the experience in Nashville to kind of cater to that group, the younger group traveling, who's willing to spend more for an experience, right? More than just the typical traveler looking for the cheapest place to stay. I was like, that's where we can capitalize. So we started in Nashville. We got into the Smoky Mountains once COVID hit, because a lot of the travel pivoted to the regional vacation destinations. They wanted out of the cities. Nashville took a beating like a lot of metro areas did for like probably 6 to 8 months. And then it kind of came back slowly. But the mountains were bonkers. We were booked at crazy rates per night, and occupancy was through the roof. So we got two there. And then I actually started doing a bunch of research while we were traveling around in our camper van, and with my business actually teaching others how to invest in short-term rentals. I have a USA-wide subscription to AirDNA, which is like data for the whole country on like occupancy and average daily rates, things like that, trends. So that's where I stumbled upon South Florida and like kind of the steadiness of that market throughout the year. It's not super seasonal. So those are the three markets that we're currently invested in.
Got it. And would you consider yourself in the like luxury Airbnb then? Is this, do you have a typical like bedroom count or certain items that come along with these Airbnbs that you like to keep consistent throughout all the ones that you're purchasing?
Yeah, I would say with each property we've done, I don't think we have necessarily luxury Airbnbs. I think luxury is in multi-million dollar property, like waterfront somewhere. I would say we have higher end, larger properties. The smallest one we have is a 2-bedroom historic townhouse in Nashville, nothing special. And then we have like a standard 4-bedroom house with a rooftop, but we kind of created special moments within it, you know, in East Nashville. The other ones were just properties we fixed up, honestly, and just kind of created more of an experience or experiences within the property.
Yeah. Have you been buying them with like 10% down vacation loan, like loans? Are you buying them as, you know, 25 or 20% down investment properties? Because I know at the beginning you were starting to save up your own money. I'm just curious, like, you know, it sounds like the way that maybe the market has shifted to 2022, where the properties that we're looking at are Airbnb hosts that are selling their furnished properties. So it's a little bit harder for us to get a discount on a property, but we don't care as much because we know how much it's going to cash flow. And if it can come furnished and it's 2,500 miles away, we don't have to do the work to furnish it. So we're cool with that. But it sounds like you were actually like increasing the value in them by fixing them up. Is that the case?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, several of them, we bought one turnkey. It worked great, right? Because we didn't have enough capital to go spend $20,000 to furnish it. So like you said, you can kind of, it's just the devil's in the details, right? My goal is to maximize cash on cash return. If I can do that better with a turnkey property, great. If I could do it better by getting a place that is less heavily competed on and less bids on for the, you know, the purchase, by doing one that needs fixing up and I have the time and resources to do it, then we've done that actually several times. Now there is a point to that method. You guys are probably familiar with the Burr method: buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. I've done this with a couple of properties with Airbnb and it's insane. I know we're talking pre-show about like the craziest deal that I've done. And if it's okay to bring that up now, I'll just dive into that because this is crazy. I thought real estate was expensive 2 years ago. Right. And it's funny looking back now, right? But the way inflation has happened over the couple of years, it's been nuts. We found a place that needed tremendous rehab in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. It's within like 10 minutes to downtown Gatlinburg. You still have mountain views and all that. We got it for $499,000. And we got the seller to pay all our closing costs too, which was wild. But we needed new floors. We converted a garage, 2-car garage, to a massive home theater room with surround sound. We took off the back deck that was falling over. We added a hot tub. We added like a sauna room and like a storage shed. So we brought it to like this really cool place that no other place in Gatlinburg at the time had kind of what we had. It was super cool. So we spent about $75,000 furnishing it. We went pretty all out with it. We spent about $110,000 on rehab and we did a 15% down investment loan. Now we split this cost with an investor that I met in Nashville. He built the houses across the street. So he kind of had the know-how on the contractors and how to go through with the rehab and the permitting. So I forget how much all in we were at, probably around 230 or 260 ish. Fast forward to January of 2022, we did a refinance, and this is 1 year after we bought this house.
And when you said all in 260 plus the purchase, so you're all in for 660 roughly, like in terms of rehab plus purchase price?
That's probably fair. Maybe a little less than that. I'd have to go back, apply. I should have pulled up the numbers for the call. But it appraised, right? Because we kind of forced the appreciation on it, adding square footage, fixing it up, making it a better place. But also with the market, the way it was, inventory super low and just pressure to put push prices higher, it appraised for $1.2 million. And we did a cash out refinance at an 80% loan to value, and we pulled out like $460,000. This is insane because we cash flowed in the first, what, 7.5 months, I think over $100,000 or right around $90,000 on that one place. So our cash on cash return was nuts, right? And not only that, but with the BRRRR method, we pulled out probably almost 2x what we put in just a year ago. So we made money just on the refinance, not including the cash flow, and we have infinite return on the equity we created in that property. So like that is mind-boggling. That's why the BRRRR method is so powerful, especially with short-term rentals.
Yeah, and that's first of all, that's an incredible story. I think now you're able to become your own bank in a way where you have that $400,000 and $400,000. Yeah. And then you can buy these high end properties and do it again and rinse and repeat. And that's really what the BRRRR method's about. But that's the perfect scenario.
That's insanity. There's a lot to unpack here. I mean, first of all, can you talk to how you decided Gatlinburg, Tennessee was where you wanted to go? And then how did you meet the partner, right, that went in on the deal with you? It just so happens that he or she was amazing with contract work and figured out, hey, we obviously got to fix the deck, but then you said the home theater room, just like certain things, like how did you know how to mold it into be something unique that would give you this cash flow per month? Obviously you probably didn't expect it to appraise for 1.2, but just the little things on like expecting cash flow and knowing that you were going to at least be a differentiator than from other properties in the area.
Yeah. I think I actually forecast based on comps in the area at the time, I thought it would appraise for like 950 to 1 million after repair value, right? Obviously with the appreciation, it's about right, going about 20% the past year, it's bringing it to 1.2. But we looked at Gatlinburg. I actually looked at Gatlinburg before Nashville, because Gatlinburg, for those that don't know, is basically the Tennessee side of the Smoky Mountain National Park, right? The other side being North Carolina. That's the Tennessee side entrance, which is way more popular than North Carolina side, but there's like 15 to 17 million visitors per year that go to the Smoky Mountain National Park. The most visited national park in the country, I think by a landslide actually. So it's crazy. There's so much development going on in Gatlinburg, Pigeon Forge, Sevierville, which are the three towns there. And vacation rentals have been around forever. Airbnb and Vrbo basically just kind of democratized short-term rentals for everyday investors like myself, especially with all the other apps that help us not have to rely on a local PM to advertise and manage the property for us. So that's why we looked at Gatlinburg. We found the partner actually because he built the two houses across the street from us. We lived in like an area that was kind of being gentrified. A lot of like teardowns, new homes, a lot of new development going on in Nashville. He built the two homes across from us. He dropped off a gift card to say, sorry for the noise. And we're like, dude, thank you for building the houses. This is helping the whole neighborhood kind of like bring up the value and whatever. So we just became friends over the next like 6 months and talked to him a lot about what we were doing with short-term rentals. I was still like only a year in at that point. And he's like, man, I would love to do a deal with you. And I'm like, sure. Like, let's find one that makes sense. Like, let's go 50-50 on equity, how much funds we're putting up. I want you to manage the rehab. My wife and I will manage the furnishing design and we'll manage the property and we'll split the cash flow 50-50. So it just kind of worked out and just happened organically. There are other ways, obviously. I would network online as much as possible, join different groups. Oftentimes, if you pay for like a course, like I have one, for example, but you could go do anyone's really. They oftentimes come with like Facebook groups that are like private groups just for networking. So mine, for example, I have several hundred people in them that are networking and brokering deals with each other to figure out like who's interested in what areas and kind of what would be a good fit for people. But you can do that on different like bigger pockets or Facebook groups. So there's a lot of ways to kind of meet people and network.
Yeah, Mike, I was going to mention so that you just laid out a deal, how this would work for people. And obviously you don't meet contractors, you know, they don't knock on your door every day, but this is kind of the picture here. 50-50, you split the equity, 50-50. You break up the who's doing what, the contracting work versus the managing, and then you split the cash flow 50-50. I think it's so worth it for somebody like that to come into the business to start to create passive income. Because once he finishes that job, this contractor, all of his work is pretty much done and he can collect it. And there's so much margin in it that it makes sense for somebody to want to be able to partner. So I've had somebody approach me. A family friend has said, like, I'd love to start an Airbnb fund. And I'm like, okay, well, like, you know, just one other thing add to my list of things that I want to do. But it's this whole thing where you have these, you know, you can pull money, you can pull resources, and with the amount of cash flow that you can bring in, it's just, there's infinite ways to partner.
I just think it's brilliant. And it, in a way of, it takes guts to go from going zero properties to all of a sudden you're burying Airbnbs in the Smoky Mountains, right? Like, just, you got to take a little bit of a risk. I just keep thinking back to the Dunkin' Donuts and Domino story and just how, how quickly it changed. And now you're making thousands of dollars per month from real estate. And it's just incredible. It can transform lives. So I'm wondering if you can also, I know we kind of are peeling back a few layers here, but just talk about some tips, tricks, and then resources that people can use to get in the game. A lot of people get excited. They hear the stories and they're like, wow, that was an incredible deal. But like, how the hell do I get started? And just maybe your recommendation from someone that's, you know, recently gone through it and seen success.
Yeah, I would say first, the most common question I get asked is, how much do I need to start? Or Michael, how much did you have when you started? And it's a bad way to start the thinking process. I would encourage you to say, well, how much do you have? And then pick a strategy that best suits the current budget you have. And with short-term rentals, it's really special because there's different strategies that have opened up over the past decade that have allowed people to start on any budget. So you don't have to do a down payment, closing costs, furniture. Like, you could do something known as rental arbitrage or corporate housing, where you create an LLC, we'll call it Michael's Corporate Housing Company. You approach landlords or property managers or for rent by owner places, whether it's an apartment, condo, or home, and say, hey, I have a business. My goal is to rent on a corporate lease and get permission to, you know, rent out to clients, whether it's traditional corporate housing for traveling nurses, work relocation, things like that. Or you also do like just travel on the weekends just for people coming into town. So that's what a lot of people do. And you're actually doing them a favor because the place is going to remain in for sale condition, right? Versus someone who's truly living in the unit. You have to keep it up, like, cleaned every single week and keep it in great condition. So there's some benefits to them. And then obviously less vacancy and turnover costs over time if it's a multi-year lease. So it can kind of be a really cool, beautiful win-win scenario for the owner and then you. So your cost is really just rent and whatever costs associated with setting up that specific lease agreement and then furniture. So it can only be a couple grand for a small place, like, easy. And then anything you bring on top, bring it in over in revenue on Airbnb, or a furnished finder, if you're doing traveling nursing, it's another website to list on, like, minus your operational expenses is pure cash flow. So much less to start. And then the strategy, well, what if I have no money? It's like, well, you can co-host for someone. You can go pull people off these old legacy expensive property managers who are charging 35% and say, hey, I'll charge you 10%, or I'll even do it for free for a month. And I'm going to do just as good, if not a better job than them. And I'm going to charge you less, right? So that's a good way to start, you know, co-hosting for someone else. Basically, you just get a cut of the revenue. So you're tied to the performance of that property.
Got it. That's awesome. We talked to Kyle Stanley at Fearless Kyle on Instagram. I think it'd be last week's episode. Yeah. And he does what you're talking about, the arbitrage for a living, and teaches other people how to do it. So it's very, very cool. I'm curious on how you, like, 3 years is not a long time. So this is like if you're listening to this episode, it's like, this is a wake up call for some people. You've done this in a very short amount of time. How did you learn the ins and outs of the Airbnb business to be confident enough to go down this path? I mean, maybe you touched on that a little bit, but I'm wondering if you could dive a little bit deeper on, like, you know, buying these types of properties, not really knowing anything about real estate. The reason why I ask this is that most people do not dive into real estate investing and have Airbnb be their first entryway into the business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, it was a little more bootstrapping than I had. Looking back, I would have done it differently, I guess I should say. I honestly just kind of networked a little bit, learned from, like, again, I had a neighbor that worked in a property management business. So I just asked them a few questions to kind of kickstart the thought process. And then I was looking online just on Airbnb to see where properties were located, how often they were booked, pick apart their calendar, see how much they were charging. Then I would find similar properties on Zillow, see what the cost of them were. And I just figured out all the operational expenses that were involved, what the down payment would need to be, how much we could charge per night, and estimated occupancy. Like, you can use AirDNA and find resources out there. And I could just kind of build this little calculator. It's super simple. and it spit out like my monthly cash flow and cash on cash return. So for me, it was like all about the numbers. The deal has to make sense. And then I got into like, well, what are the top performing properties in the market? You can find that on Airbnb, AirDNA. What features or amenities do they have? Or how many people do they sleep? What parts of town are they located to maximize revenue, right? Occupancy and average daily rate. So just with that basic set of information, I really don't like to overcomplicate it. I was like, I think I understand it. It wasn't super complicated, like trading stock options, which I tried to understand for years. And I was just like, this is too hard for me. It seems risky. It's like, if I understand the numbers, real estate is not super complicated, just when you get down to the nitty gritty. So honestly, that's what I did. I think for other people, I'd recommend consuming free content out there. Like myself, there's tons of other people doing short-term rental content or real estate, different podcasts. Like I would start with free content first and try to find mentors or do paid mentorships or coaching. Like I would have paid for that if I know what I know now, because I think it would have actually expedited my journey that much faster. Because I've waited 6 to 12 months before I even finally built up the balls to go make that first investment. If I had somebody say, here's the blueprint, I would have done it in the first month, because it would kind of would have settled those nerves a little bit.
Yeah. It sounds like you have this really cool system built out for self-managing and are more of an advocate for managing it yourself than paying the 25, 30%. And Ryan and I are so on the fence about this because we want to streamline our business as much as possible. And we have some e-commerce going on and we have some real estate and we have our W-2 jobs. And now we're getting into other ventures of how to generate active income. So we're like, do we have like the time to actually manage one of our next ventures, the Airbnb? Just speak to the systems that you have in place, kind of let people set them free to how you're spending like what? You said a couple of hours a week on this. That's not.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, do you have 30 minutes a week extra?
Yeah, sure. We just talked for 30 minutes. So yeah,
if I could. Yeah. So the cool thing about Airbnb, it depends on the investment, because it can be a lot of effort and time to set up, depending what it is, right? I said it involves rehab. If you're doing some of that yourself or working with contractors, furnishing it, that takes time. Once they're set up, or if you get a turnkey place, leverage technology and apps now that can automate messaging. They can automate calendar syncing with your cleaners. They can even auto review guests on Airbnb for you. Like it can automatically change the door code for guests. Like all this cool technology that's out now can help automate a lot of the business that used to be manual. I don't pay for marketing or anything. People go to Airbnb and they find us, and then we just appear higher in search over time because we do a good job. So you can set it up in a way that it probably only takes you about 30 minutes a week to manage a single property. And with scale, eventually I would like to hire somebody as a co-host or maybe a PM, broker a deal with them and hand them, here's $1 million worth of business now, which is crazy to say, like you said earlier, but like, give me a discount on your management fee type of thing. But if your goal, like for someone who's just starting out, who maybe doesn't have different things they're working on, like you guys, especially them, I wouldn't pay 20 to 30% to a PM that takes you 30 minutes a week. I guess you have to think about what else you could be doing with that 30 minutes. If the value of your time is higher spent elsewhere, then yeah, hire a PM immediately. But if not, and most people it's not, right? Could be tens of thousands of dollars of time for the year. So that's the way I look at it, at least. So until you get to a point where you can't scale further because you're so bogged down with, hey, you know, how does the toaster work? You know, just that doesn't happen a ton, but just random, just little things that bubble up per property. Eventually you're going to want to outsource for sure.
Absolutely. I think part of it comes down to just our dislike for being in the weeds on things. But I personally work in customer service, so I kind of get that kind of aspect of the business and setting up the systems. I know there's a bunch of different ones that you can use to help automate. And like you said, the automatic messages, then hiring your cleaner and then having the cleaner's calendar synced with yours and then like put them in. Can you talk to a couple of the programs that you use that kind of help you just kind of aggregate your business and let it flow?
Yeah. So I really like using AirDNA just on the like market analysis side and help me pick a market and then crunch numbers on specific properties within a market. Once the property is set up, you know, obviously we list on Airbnb and Vrbo, but we use a property management software or PMS tool. I use Guesty for Hosts, and that helps do those things like the automated messaging, for example. It also cross sync your calendars cross platform. So if you're going to list on Airbnb, Vrbo, booking.com, direct booking site, if you get a booking on one, you don't want to have to go manually block the dates on the other because you don't want to get double booked, right? So it'll kind of do that for you in the background. I use a pricing tool called Price Labs, and this will basically, they use data and analytics, kind of like your DNA, to help do intuitive price analytics and predictive pricing for your property based on customizations you set and demand in the market. So they'll like color code your calendar based on high demand and low demand days and adjust your pricing based on your inputs and what data they have at their fingertips. And they'll push pricing out to your property. So that's super cool too.
Whoa. It literally pumps the pricing out for you. Like you just kind of put in all
the property. You have to put You have to put the customizations. You could put as little or as many. You could let them ride with it. And then based on those customizations and then demand that they see, like in the booking volume on the platforms, they will adjust your pricing up or down to help you capture higher nightly rate on busy days and then lower it to help you capture bookings on days where you may have ordinarily been a little priced out.
Whoa. It seems like you're not the first person to mention these three platforms, and everybody's just saying like kind of the same thing. It's like, listen, like 30 minutes to an hour a week. Where are you seeing the most time spent then? Just with all of this, is it replying to one-off messages? Is it just getting things set up? I'm just curious and like trying to conceptualize like a day in the life, right? Or like a week in the life of like, if we do this tomorrow and we got to be ready the next week, how are we supposed to kind of run our ship?
So once you're set up, I would say that honestly, the most amount of time spent is probably answering just one-off questions. Like, hey, can I check in early? My flight gets in at 10 a.m. I know check-in's not till 4. Clearly we say no early check-in, but sometimes we'll try to accommodate guests or charge an early check-in fee. Usually it's just those simple questions to answer that takes the most time. I would say other little things that bubble up are just minor maintenance things, which we can still try and automate as much as possible, but inevitably you're still going to have to coordinate some of that with handymen or your cleaning team. Right. But that's really the two biggest things probably that eat up more time than other items.
Okay, cool. And then I'm trying to, I'm like envisioning myself in the property now. Do you have specific, I don't want to say cookie cutter, but like go-to products or go-to things that you want on your property? So for example, a Ring camera or like an owner's closet or a guest book, like just things that you specifically maybe customize to your portfolio?
Yeah. So a couple, so I guess two answers to that. The first is just really must haves. Like I have a security camera on the front of every single one of our properties, highly recommended, either Ring floodlight or Ring doorbell. I like the floodlight because the lights come on for guests if it's not a well-lit entrance. Wi-Fi, like decent Wi-Fi. So you can use these devices, and then smart lock. You don't have to have one that changes codes automatically, which Guest Key can do for you, but having one that is, you don't need a physical key. Right? Physical key backup is necessary, but no physical key is great because a guest can just come punch in the code. They're in, they're out, easy. I will say as far as what we do, like we have a lock cleaner closet and some other things, but as far as standing out that we do specifically, I aim to try and create 1 to 3 key experiences within every property. Because think about your attention span on TikTok or Instagram. We have changed as people. Our attention span is literally like less than 2 seconds. If you don't grab my attention, I'm like, forget you. Next. Ooh, this is cool. Let me look at this for 8 seconds, you know? So I really look at Airbnb and don't think differently about that because I am a consumer on Airbnb too. And it's like, this isn't within my price range, or that's not cool. Those photos suck. This doesn't tell me anything about the listing. Ooh, this is cool. Let me learn more about this. You click on that one photo or the listing description and you get to a splash page with 5 photos. Those are the 5 photos that you need to sell your property. If they're not interested, they're not going to scroll through the photos. They're not going to care to read your description or about the space. So the 1 to 3 key experiences, or maybe like the 5 key photos, what are those moments going to be? I already am thinking about that before I even crunch numbers on a property. Can I create a cool experience here? What amenities are key for this specific area? Do I need space for a hot tub? Do I need to put in a pool table? Whatever it is, can I create a mural or like a custom photo moment that creates a memory? You could sell an experience better than a product, I think, because I'd rather be in a race to like the premium experience versus a race to the bottom on pricing, because that's a loser's game.
I couldn't agree more with that. We just booked an Airbnb up in the Pocono Mountains, different than Smokies, but you look at all, you truly do look at all the pictures, and I had like 2 seconds. Nah, looks shitty. Nah, I don't want it. But then if it has that one picture that draws you in, right? You said you go to the splash page, there's a bunch of different things. If I see that the garage is made into a game room, or if they have a projector room or whatever you call it, like a movie theater room, or they have a big pool table, the hot tub, like there's just things you're like, oh, this one inches out the other property that I'm looking at. And I'm going to go with this one. Even if it's a little bit more dough, it has a cool experience, like you said. And I think that was a good way to put it.
Yeah. I was thinking about this too, and how much of what you do super well is marketing. And I noticed that obviously with your social media, but I imagine the way your social media got like this is because your business is also run similarly. And it's funny you say that because I've been to, I will have been to Austin twice for bachelor parties within the past year. And guys aren't as much like this, but for bachelorette parties, like one of the places we stayed at had like this super Instagrammable wall. And I was looking at it. None of the guys took photos, right? But like, I know for a fact that like, if that catches an eye of, I don't know, 25 to 30 year old, somebody getting married, like with a big group, like how much of life today is marketing yourself and putting yourself on social and wanting to have these Instagrammable moments. So standing out like that, even just something as simple as a wall, which is literally could probably cost you like $2,000, and that might be high, right? To do this, to just separate yourself, I think could bring you thousands and thousands and thousands of extra dollars in revenue.
Was this one of those like grass walls with the neon signs?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
So that's exactly what I think of when I think of like an Instagrammable wall.
Yeah. It's or, so like, simple. Or like one of those.
People want it though.
It's like with the wings coming out, and I'm just like, oh God, it's funny. It's funny, but it's like, works. It works. It really does work.
You guys are describing some of my properties. It's hilarious. Yeah. The first property we ever did. And I'll tell you why we did this. So a lot of people don't know that there's probably hundreds, but there are dozens of interactive murals. There's hundreds of murals around Nashville, like on can't like, that's what you do now. You open a business, you pay 20 grand for a mural on the wall. And it draws people because they want to take photos in front of it. And I thought this was silly until I go drive by on a Saturday. And after a celebrity like Taylor Swift or somebody takes a photo in downtown Nashville with these giant wings, it looks like they're on her back. And now you have hundreds of people on a Saturday morning, literally they're spending hours just to take the photo and tell their following, whether it's 100 people or 100,000 million people, look where I am, look at this photo. They're spending they come to Nashville to do that. And so I was like, what if I could bring that experience inside? So we called this place Butterfly B&B. I paid a mural artist $2,500. I had like a mosaic wings in my mind for butterfly wings. So, and it says Nashville written above it. And we're not even in downtown. We're like 10 minutes from downtown. We book out months in advance on most weekends. And our usual pricing for a Saturday night is between $750 and $1,100 a night. And we're charging almost 2x what our neighbors typically charge, because we have that mural on the living room wall.
2x.
Bachelorettes want, yeah, sometimes 2x, because they want to take that photo. It's nothing special. It's the same floor plan. The two houses next door, the same floor plan. The ones across the street are one less bedroom, same floor plan. The four next door, two bedrooms, same floor plan. We're charging 2x than the four bedrooms because we have that the photo moment, which is crazy. But for them, it's worth it because they get that moment for the rest of their life where they're wearing the tiara and they have the dress on and they got the girls next to them all in the same outfit and they get that photo that is
I believe you, we're not knocking it, it's just funny.
That's why I was
laughing.
I'm
not the numbers guy, dude. Like I'm not the numbers guy in this thing. I'm more, my mind is creative. I like to draw, like all this stuff. Like I'm thinking about different colors for our Instagram posts and all this, like what we should have here in line. Like that is the most exciting part to me about the properties, which sounds weird, but I think that's what differentiates Corey and I. We're like, he'll be on the numbers and now we can make more. But if you want me to go make it like come up with a crazy design or make it prettier, like I know that sounds weird, but like, dude, I like that. Like, I think that's cool. And I can envision things more so than just like giving a shit about, okay, is $500, $1,000. I don't know, dude. Like it just doesn't excite me as much. So that's so cool that there's an opportunity for creatives to get in there and make a name for themselves in this market, in this, I guess you want to say this industry.
I would bet interior designers have had a spike in the last 3 years of just their business and their creativity and how much they've meant to, you know, Airbnb hosts. You were just talking about, what's your mortgage, if you don't mind me asking, on that property that you can book for, what'd you say, $1,000 a night? Like,
so we ended up refinancing it. We bought it at 495. We refied at like 525. I don't know, but the mortgage is probably like 2000 or $2,500.
Okay.
But like just for example, this is funny. This is the best month ever. It's funny enough to talk about this property. We're doing just shy of 17,000 in revenue in April, 2022.
17,000. So let me just like break this down for people it's funny. I went right to the numbers. You were just saying this, but like, let me just break this down for people. $17,000. Let's say your mortgage is $2,000. Let's say, dude, if you had a furnace go every month, let's add $3,000 to that, right? Which is impossible. But like you're talking about, like at worst case scenario, with all of the other things that you could possibly have to pay for, the difference in between $17,000 and, I don't know, put on $5,000 for your expenses for that month, which is probably high. You know, you just made $12,000, and that's in 1 month. And for people to, the way that I conceptualize why I think this is such a great thing is that for me to, Ryan and I have good jobs. We like our jobs. They're stimulating to a point that we tolerate them and like the people that we work with. But for me to make $12,000 extra in a month, I would have to have, like I would have to have something astronomical happen that month, right? Like extra from what my salary and what I'm normally making commission. So to be able to do this and spend that couple hours a week, it's like, I'm not suggesting it's for everybody, but if you have one or two of these properties, you can change the trajectory of your income in your life.
For sure. I look at it like, instead of going to work, even if you love your job, it's like, you're still trading time for money to go pay for the liabilities in your life, your mortgage, your car, your family, food, things like that. If you could supplement that and let your assets that you invest in pay for all the liabilities in your life, your assets being cash flowing properties, for example, all right? So that monthly income pays for, that's financial freedom. So you can go to work and not have, you have zero stress about money. Not that you do now anyway, right? But you would have zero stress because you know that it's still getting paid for on the back end. Oh, you want a new car? It's like, in my mind, this is crazy too. Like my wife just bought a Range Rover, which is not a cheap car, but we're just bought, before we bought that car, we invested all the money from 3 cash out refinances directly into 2 more rentals that'll produce thousands of dollars a month of cash flow each. It's like not even a third of one of those pays for the payment of the Range Rover conservatively, right? So it's like the asset pay for the liability. So I want to invest the money first to pay for all the future liabilities versus paying for the liability first and then scramble to pay for that monthly payment.
Yeah, we put a post.
The trap a lot of people get into.
Yeah. I mean, we put a post on our Instagram and I don't, I mean, I could pull it up right now, but it was like, don't fund today's lifestyle with tomorrow's income. And that's exactly what you're saying. It's just reverse of, it's kind of reverse engineering. And that's what Ryan and I are doing with our personal income is like, how can we make our active income turn it into passive income and turn that passive income into more passive income so that passive income can then support the lifestyle that we ultimately want? So there's just so many ways to do it and having the Airbnb story. But I love that that is like a perfect synopsis of you just got, you know, double the amount of somebody next to you because of the creativity that's involved in it. That's really
cool. Yeah, you're trading your time for money and that you kind of put it into a perfect little box with a bow on it, right? It's just like, even if you love your job, how much time are you spending of your life to go do that job just to fund your lifestyle and all the other things in it? And so you, there is a trade-off if people are interested in, and you clearly scaled it faster than most. I do want to ask you this question. I know we haven't touched on this at all before, but you went from 0 to 6, right? And you went, your income went skyrocketed. Do you work with a CPA for tax planning purposes? And can you talk to just like maybe that arm of the business? Just, it's very important for a lot of people and a lot of people have no idea what they're doing. So can you talk to maybe like from a guy that has, you know, is going through the regular W-2 income to an astronomical amount, like thousands per month, like how important it is to have someone out there just to track everything, make sure it's done properly. I'm just so intrigued.
Yeah, for sure. As soon as we made the first real estate investment, I was, because I understood at the very base level, I don't understand tax code at all. And I didn't care to read through tax code because most CPAs don't know all the tax code out there. That's why they specialize, right? So I was like, if we have a real estate investment, I know there's tax benefits. I'm not going to spend hours and our days trying to figure out how to actually do my tax return. And also tax planning, like, hey, Mr. CPA, like, what do I do if I'm starting this LLC or investing in this asset or creating this business? Like, what is the best way to structure things and most tax advantageous? What can I write off? Right. So yeah, we did hire a CPA who I just asked on a Facebook group or a BiggerPockets post, like any recommendations. Fortunately, I found a guy who was a year before opening his own practice. I don't even know if he's taking on clients anymore, but he was kind of started specializing in real estate clients. And he also, this is a big criteria for me, he also owns several properties himself. And he is very pro you know, taxpayer and not pro IRS. And I mean that in the most legal way possible. Like he's like, I'm going to make sure you do not pay a penny more than you are supposed to. You already pay enough to the government. And so hearing that from him and having him have experience, not only with real estate clients, but investing in himself, that was attractive to me. So yeah, you could write off all sorts of stuff. You know, I mean, that's the beauty of being an investor or a business owner is you do not pay the level of taxes. Cause I've been a high income earner before my W-2 job. And as you guys know, you pay an absorbing amount of taxes, like insane. And there's nothing you can really write off. And a lot of people don't understand that. So investing in a real estate, there's a lot of tax benefits that you get, which can reduce your overall tax liability, which is great.
Yeah, this is such important stuff. And, you know, just a caveat, none of us are attorneys or CPAs. So like you take the advice with the grain of salt. But this happened to me earlier this year. I had like one of my best months ever at work. And I remember doing the math on the amount that I got paid on the actual commission. And it was like 58% of the sale came to me. And I'm like, this is insane. Like, I'm literally, that just means that however long it took me to, let's say it took me a year to finalize that sale, I just took 5.6 months of the money that it took me in time and handed it to the government. So that's the advocate for putting these properties in LLCs to do the planning, which we actually haven't done. We have CPAs, but we haven't done the tax planning through the year. And that's like,
that's the next phase. That's why I asked it. Cause we're going to be coming into, you know, knock on wood, a lot more income in the next year. And so I'm just thinking, forecasting. I was like, listen, I don't want to get hit with a massive tax bill that I was not expecting. And I know there's a ton of strategy behind it. You know, we could talk to how you were expecting not to pay taxes this year. And then you got hit with a little bit of a bill, but no, it sucked not to get a refund. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I thought I planned it the right way with the real estate to get a refund and I didn't. So it is what it is. But
I actually look at it with the refund. I'd rather pay more out of pocket and have a tax bill and get a refund because what do we have? I just did a video on this on YouTube today, 6 straight months of inflation, year over year increase. 8.5% was the inflation increase from March 2021 to 2022. That's insane. So if you had overpaid in taxes throughout the year, and a lot of people are really excited to get a refund, which you should be excited because it's money you're getting back in your pocket, but that was money that the government just held for you. Where, hey, I could have invested this 12 months ago in the stock market or in a rental property and have it produce a return for me during that time. So what I actually realized is a lot of real estate investors, because you're supposed to pay quarterly taxes or, you know, to the IRS to avoid a penalty. The penalty is like 4 or 5% or something like that, and maybe more, don't quote me. But if they know that they're getting ready to invest in a big deal where they're going to get a 10 to 20% cash on cash return, they'll eat that 5%. By not paying quarterly taxes. I'm not saying it's not tax advice, but they'll invest because the difference, the delta, is they're going to come out 10% higher than they would if they just paid the government right then and there. So there's a lot of these different tax strategies that I had no idea about until I was talking with my CPA and didn't even know they exist. And he's like, well, this is what some of my clients do and something for you to consider. And I'm like, this is fascinating. You know,
got it.
There's so many loopholes and there's so much money to be saved and or put into different silos, right? I just thought the reason I brought it up to you, meant you brought up the Range Rover, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Wondering if that's a write-off. And I don't know.
Range Rover is not a write-off, but
there you go.
I did order the Cybertruck. It was supposed to be here this year. It probably won't be here until like 2030. Who knows?
It might have a nice little Twitter logo on it when you get it. Dude.
Hey, I'm okay with that. Yeah, that was going to be the business write-off because you can accelerate the depreciation, right, for vehicles.
Because it weighs so much, right?
Vehicle weighing over like 6,000 pounds, I think it is. So you can accelerate that basically right up the whole vehicle in the first year. So it's pretty interesting. So like if I buy the Cybertruck, $100,000 car, I can potentially reduce my tax liability by $100,000. So instead of paying 35% on that, right? It's a great way to, if you're going to buy a vehicle anyway, you could buy a specific type, specific weight, and you could basically pay less in taxes throughout the year.
Cool.
For that year.
Yeah, makes sense. I have a couple questions before we wind down the show. I think one of them is you've had this acceleration in the past 3 years. I'm curious what your future goals are with the Airbnb business. Well, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to continue to grow this thing, double it, triple it? Or are you like, I know you spent the year traveling, right? So what are your future goals with your business?
So yeah, I'd love to continue to get more properties. I think right now my wife and I are being a little more opportunistic. So at first it was scale, 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 financial freedom, and then scale up, get a house. She got a new car. She's pregnant, by the way. So she's due in October, which is great. So a lot of things happening life-wise. So right now we're trying to kind of save back up some capital and be more opportunistic to where, like, whenever a home run deal comes about, or maybe the stock market takes a dip, we're ready to deploy capital fast to capture those home run deals, like that Burr deal we talked about earlier, to like be ready to pounce on it, or maybe buy something cash and then fix it up, refi and do all that. So I would love to continue to scale, but right now I'm just more focused on some family stuff and scaling social media and some, kind of like my e-course and coaching business as well, because that's a big part of my income too. And I'm able to do that from a desk at home versus maybe trying to like broker deals or going out and finding properties to invest in. So kind of all of the above.
Awesome. Well, we're going to get into your courses and your social media in a second here, but the last question before we get to the kind of the end, or the last couple segments, is there's been some things going on in the market. We posted about it on our Instagram, about there's certain areas of the country that are limiting the purchases of Airbnbs, because I think the sentiment, or what they think is going on, is that there's a lot of investors that are driving up the market because they're bidding way over asking price, because the revenue that they're bringing in is significantly higher than what it matters to them for them to pay the mortgage. They don't care. So Atlanta, for example, put a law in that says that you can only have two short-term rentals and one has to be your primary residence. So how do you think something like this will affect the rest of the market? Do you think other cities are going to continue to adopt this? I'm just curious, because it affects people in the future for purchasing.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I'm kind of torn between the two, because part of me wants to say it's free country. You should be allowed to do what you want with your money. If you want to invest in short-term rent it, then that's great. As long as you're abiding by any HOA rules or any existing, you know, regulations, like you're paying your taxes, all that. The other part of me is like, you know, I understand from that perspective. I think in highly residential areas, maybe you shouldn't be short-term renting. Like maybe you should be more specific about the locations. I think Nashville is a good example to where they're not cracking down to the levels of Atlanta, which I think that's crazy, by the way, that you can't invest there and do short-term rental just if you don't live there. Like that's insane. Nashville at least says it has to be zoned in a certain area, like commercially zoned or a specific area or a planned unit development that was built for short-term rentals. So at least the entire community or the majority of the community is short-term rentals. So it's not like you're disturbing all the neighbors, disrupting a micro community within a city. So it's kind of a balancing act. I think it actually plays an advantage for investors if you can find a place that is legally zoned to be short-term rented in a place like Nashville, because there's essentially a soft cap on the market. There's only so many places that you can invest in that specific market in short-term rent. Whereas at Gatlinburg or by the beach, like most cities like that are reliant on tourism for tax revenue. So they're going to be much more lenient on rules. Plus they've existed long before Airbnb did. So there's less regulation, but the increase, if you look on AirDNA, has gone up by like 50%, the supply has in a lot of these markets. Whereas Nashville has been pretty steady, actually has dropped since pre-COVID. So it's just about knowing the local laws, and if, you know, whether you agree with them or not, it's just kind of like do your research, do your due diligence, and just figure out where you're legally allowed to do it. Because the last thing you want to do is buy a place and not be able to operate.
Cool. Great insight. I have one kind of coupled with that, but just kind of the way of the world right now, they're talking about rate hikes and rate increases over time. Are you concerned about those at all for someone trying to get into real estate investing, and just, you know, how long do you think they'll last? Just kind of give us your thoughts on the overall landscape.
Yeah, no idea how long they're going to last. It's such a weird thing that the Fed does to manipulate the market, right? First with COVID, just to back it up, they print all this money, they lower rates to avoid it. Drastic recession, which probably should have happened, right? We're in a big debt bubble. COVID happens, the economy shuts down. There's no way it should have bounced back that fast, but it did, because they did those things to try to stimulate the economy. Now, with all that money being printed and there's already a really low inventory of housing and low interest rates, it just, everyone wants to buy a house to lock that in, because they can buy more because there's, you know, they can afford a higher monthly payment by buying a bigger house with low interest rate. Now they're trying to creep that back up with interest rates to basically, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Let's pump the brakes. This happens a lot. I don't know how long it's going to last, but I think what it's going to do is it's going to take out a lot of the buyers, or basically reduce the amount of purchasing power each buyer has. So it's going to, the goal is to kind of suppress things like real estate and kind of calm everything down. I think real estate prices are going to level out somewhat. I think in markets where inventory is still really low and there's mass migrations to, like in Nashville, Austin, Texas, South Florida, I think they're going to kind of steadily increase with time. But that's kind of what I'm seeing or thinking in the future. I think it still comes down to the numbers though, right? You just have to factor in if the interest rate is going to be higher, make sure you factor that into your analysis and your mortgage payment. If the cash on cash return still meets or exceeds your goal or expectation, then in my opinion, the deal still makes sense.
Yeah, it's funny when you go on YouTube or you go onto Instagram or TikTok, it's just like people love, for the clicks and for the viral, they love the doomsday scenario. It's like everybody loves the doomsday scenario. And it's like, I see it all the time. It's like, we're in the next crash. We're going. And here's the way that I look at it. And I don't claim to know anything. I'm just giving you my opinion.
So you're honest.
Yeah, exactly. I think that if your goal is to hold long term, I don't think you're in trouble at any point. When you buy real estate, I think that will there be some leveling out in the market? I think there probably will be. And I think there should be, because I think it's absolutely crazy and unsustainable. But I think if you're looking to hold real estate for the long term, I just don't see this becoming an issue. And there's not enough supply in the market and the lending standards are not near what they were in 2008. I just don't, like, everyone's like, it's going to repeat itself. Like, it just doesn't seem like that to me. And again, take that with a grain of salt, because you know, I don't know that much, but I just figured I'd throw my 2 cents in there. So I'm still excited as ever about investing in real estate. And yeah. I'm not excited about paying 7% or 8%, but there's, you know, if you hold and you play your position the right way, you'll always be able to refinance as these rates come down, because they're not going to stay up there.
Yeah. Invest for cash flow, not appreciation. I think that's where people get in the most trouble in real estate, is where they're highly leveraged and holding something where they need to profit on the sale of property, like a flip. Right. Totally. So if you guys are investing for cash flow, I think you're good as long as, you know, you're holding long term, like you said. So I like your point there.
Exactly. Cool. I think we made it to the core four. And in the core four, we're going to ask the same four questions just to get you know that we ask all of our guests to get to know you a little bit better. Do you have a favorite business book, maybe real estate investing book, mindset book, something that helped you kind of frame where you were going?
So the one book that I think was a tipping point for me mindset wise, which doesn't come up a lot when this question gets asked, but it's called Cashflow Quadrant. It's a sequel, kind of a sequel to Rich Dad Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki and the Rich Dad team. The main takeaway from that book was the Cashflow Quadrant, which if you guys aren't familiar with, it's four parts, right? So you have employee, self-employed, business owner, and investor. Those are the different quadrants. Like one side of the quadrant, you're trading time for money, and the other, you're creating businesses or investments that are more passive, and, you know, exponentially build your income and wealth. So that was the key takeaway, understanding that, but really understanding the risk element of investing is risky. Like, I'm afraid to lose money. The biggest thing from this book for me was the point he made where he's talking about, is it riskier to work the rest of your life in a job that you may or may not like until you're 65 or 70 years old and hope to retire? Is that not riskier than investing your money, especially when you're young, into something that's a calculated risk? Like, that was like, holy crap. Because I spent years not investing so much of my income because I was nervous of like, what if the volatility of the stock market happens, or right, what if I don't make money in a real estate investment? So that was my big takeaway.
Yeah. And it's never been more true than it is right now. When you try to go earn a living at a W-2 job and inflation is 7 or 8% and your raise is 3, and then you're like, well, I actually just lost money making more money. And then your buying power is taken even more. So it's like, yeah, if you don't do something extra, and that's maybe an unfortunate position that we're in with an inflationary period of our lives, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you used to be able to live a nice life by investing in your 401k. But that's not to say that it's not possible now, because if you make enough income, you probably can do that and retire early. But the whole thing is that the more buckets you have and the more separate income streams, passive and active, the faster you're probably going to get to that level of comfort and move out of a level of desperation, which is sadly where a lot of our country is. So that's a great book. I've read that book. I thought it was better than Rich Dad Poor Dad, actually, but I, because I'm like more like, I needed to know like the ins and outs. And I like the philosophical stuff too, but I would say that Rich Dad Poor Dad's more philosophical and cash flow quadrants more like practical. So
cool. Yeah. Second question, the core four, and I know everybody's at a different stage of their investing journey. So this may, you're making this monthly with your properties. So take this with a grain of salt, but curious how you would use invest or spend an additional $50,000 if Corey and I just handed you straight cash right now. How would you deploy it and why?
I would 100% hands down. I would go in to do like 4 to 5 rental arbitrage deals. Because if I can do, let's say $10,000 each into 5 different rental arbitrage deals that I could easily cash flow $2,000 a month, I'm at $10,000 a month cash flow.
So with an arbitrage deal, that's a creative answer. So with the arbitrage deals, don't you have to be, based on your example earlier, be renting one of those properties out and like going and living in there? And then
No. So it's actually different because you're signing a corporate lease, not a residential lease. So the intent is not to live there. The intent is to get permission at you or the business renting this, saying I have permission to furnish it and re-rent it to my clients. Right. So you're renting it as a business and creating income off of that. So if you're able to do that on a, the cost barrier of entry is so much lower than a buy and hold investment because there's no down payment, no closing cost, no credit. Right. So you establish an LLC, a few $100, you know, call it your corporate housing company, whatever you want to call it, and you're off to the races. So, and the cash on cash return, it's not abnormal for it to be like 1 to 300% because there's a down payment and the cash flow is somewhat similar to a buy and hold, which is crazy. No equity, pure cash flow play. But that's how I would do $50,000 because I would have to stretch to do $50,000 for a big Airbnb, let alone not, you know, by myself or versus partnering with someone, or I could go do that and create $10,000 a month cash flow.
That's interesting. How does the repairs and maintenance work on that? If somebody, one of your tenants that you're renting out to the Airbnb, if they break something, it's on you. But normal wear and tear, like it's, you said there's no appreciation, which is true, but like you're not in that situation, you're not paying for the roof, you're not paying for the water heater or the furnace or any of those things that go, correct?
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. So I would say anything that's like a physical structure aspect of the house, yeah, that's probably on the homeowner. I would say if it helps you broker the deal with the homeowner to allow you to do a corporate lease and re-rent, is to say, hey, minor maintenance stuff, like if a guest breaks something, obviously one, you could charge the guest and they'll pay for it. Two, if the sink clogs up or the toilet does, like you could just pay for it. It's no big deal. Just call it a cost of business, cost of doing business.
Cool. So question three, what's been your biggest mistake in your investing journey or your real estate investing journey? And how have you learned from it?
So I would say the biggest mistake for me was probably not adopting automation tools early on. I didn't adopt the automated messaging, the automated pricing early enough. And that was just being lazy. Like I didn't do research on like what was available. I was like, here's Airbnb. It's easy. I'll copy and paste check-in instructions. As soon as I got that second property, I was like, this is not sustainable. Really quickly found out that it's really easy to automate messaging and stuff. So leveraging technology and paying for a small fee per month for technology, or maybe for someone else to help kind of coach you up, 100% worth it.
Cool. I really like that one. Last question is, what do you want your legacy to be? So what gets you out of bed every morning to do what you do? Basically, what's your why?
I think, oh man, that's a great one. I think like it just all revolves around financial freedom and what that can mean to any individual or any family. I mean, it's been life-changing for me and, you know, my wife's pregnant with our first kid and just knowing that when that kid is born, I don't have to leave the house if I don't want to, like I'm here. Like I don't have to spend time elsewhere. And it's like, you can be there for the important things that matter in life. And that can be for anybody, you know? So just having that stability and having your time, because no one on their deathbed that was asked what you wish you spent more time doing, no one ever said, I wish I worked more. Right. There's probably a whole bunch of other things, travel, family, whatever. So it's like thinking from that perspective, like that puts life into perspective. So I think and just the aspect of financial freedom.
Yeah. Not only worked more, but like made more, they would probably say that they made more money too. They wish they like, that's not something they say. So like if somebody makes $10 million in their life versus somebody who makes $2 million or whatever it is, like, I don't think I would be, you know, I haven't been on my deathbed, but I would venture to say that's not a conversation that they have.
Right.
It's all about the memories and the time and the person they didn't call or the somebody that they didn't talk to, or like those would be the regrets, which all stems from having your time back to be able to do those things. So yeah, it's a great answer. So thanks for sharing.
Cool.
Last drop.
Let's do it.
Okay. So knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your younger self? We didn't even ask. How old are you?
I'm 29.
29. Maybe talk to your 18-year-old self right now. What would you tell him?
Well, one, I would tell myself, which is impossible to tell an 18-year-old, to like not take things so seriously at that point in your life, right? I think I would have been a better athlete, a better person to coach, a better son, like all the, a better brother, like all these things, like not, don't take things too seriously. Two, like things don't have to happen overnight, but they can happen a lot quicker than you also probably think, or quicker than maybe your parents will tell you. So, you know, you can, if you want to become a millionaire, you could probably do it in 2 years. Like, I think there's a way to do it. If you want to become financially free, you could probably do it in a year. But you have to be willing to like learn. It's not necessarily like I have to grind 100 hours a week. It's like, no, you have to learn like how to do those things. So just like expedite the learning path and again, not take things too seriously, because that can make you pretty miserable.
Yeah. It's amazing the time horizons that people put on themselves. And I do it to myself too. Like, it's going to take me X amount of years to get to this position. And it's like, well, if you think that it's going to take that long, it probably will. So how long do you really want it to take? And I know it sounds like kind of airy and philosophical and just like that's fluff, but it's not, I don't think it is. I really think it's more about like, what can I do in the next year? You don't want to be sprinting to the point where you can't breathe, but what can you shorten that 5-year horizon to 1 year? And I think you'd be amazed at what you can accomplish. I know that we probably didn't think that we'd be in the position that we are now. And I don't even think we've accomplished that much yet, but we're still so much further ahead than we thought we would be.
Move your timeline or your deadline up. Yeah. That's what we talked about. Like humans are so good at adapting and growing and changing to like everything that gets thrown at you. It's like, all right, let's actually challenge ourselves. Like if a gun was pointed to your head and you had a year to become financially free, could you do it? Absolutely. You could.
Take 2 months.
Yeah. But it's just like, something else happened. And like there's obstacles and there's things that take your attention away and like things you want to do to enjoy, enjoy life too. Cause you never know. It's so short. And that's the game, right? That people go through in their head every single day. It's just insane to think about. But Corey and I, the reason bringing it up is like we said, January 1 of this year, like, dude, this is the go year. Like, we're just going for it. Like, it's yes to pretty much everything as long as it's calculated. And we're just like, we keep reminding ourselves of it because we're like, some days we're just like, holy shit, we're doing so much. We got to go in this direction for e-commerce. We got to go this direction for the podcast, this direction for real estate. And it's like, how do we siphon off what we're going to do? And it's all good things, right? So in December, I want to look over at them and be like, dude, we fucking did it.
And the funny part about that whole thing is that talking to somebody like you, it's almost like, damn, we didn't put enough on our schedule for a year. Like what, we could do more. So it's inspiring. And that kind of, brings us to the end here. I want to talk about your course. So if you could give us kind of a synopsis on it and just like, maybe if people want to network with you, how do they find you? What kind of services do you offer? Because you're really big on TikTok and like people love your content. So just talk to us about it.
Yeah, thanks. I would say I always encourage people to take advantage of free content first anyway, before you consider a course of mine or anyone else's. So I try to put out a lot of valuable content. TikTok, Instagram, it's just at mElefante6. And you can find all my resources just through link in bio. I offer a variety of things. The course itself, I never thought of myself as a course creator, but I had a lot of people ask for this resource. So I finally put it together and the results from people that have taken it have been overwhelmingly positive. And like that has been life-changing for me. Obviously it's been a great income stream, but seeing other people take the course and be like, hey, I'm cash flowing $8,000 a month on my first Airbnb. I'm like, well, one, I should be charging you more too. That is insane. Like that's life-changing, you know? So that is super cool. So the course itself is like a complete step-by-step guide from start to finish, the entire short-term rental Airbnb life cycle, how I do everything, all my resources, templates, all that stuff, screen share demos. Then you get access to a Facebook group with hundreds of other people, soon to be thousands, to network and share resources. I'm very active in that group too, but yeah, that's that.
This is a testament to sharing your journey, people. This man has 730,000 followers on TikTok and this is, again, I was saying this before the episode, this isn't to knock you, but you don't have 100 properties. Like you're doing an amazing job. Like, you know, you would think that like, there's this, like this, you have to get this, like this like level of validity to be able to obtain that. And what you've done is just been authentic with your own journey. People relate to it. And the relatability aspect is what makes things go viral in a lot of sense. So put your journey, put your story out there. It's what we've done. And it's worked for us. Someone's we're not at 730,000, but we're
not yet.
No, but also we're not all of a sudden $1 million. I know it's I know it's six properties, no, but yeah, it's a massive return.
I didn't
return.
Mean that in like the, I just meant that it's like, it's what you've done is attainable. Like it's a real true thing that other people can do. And that's why we're sharing the story. That's
exactly right. 29 years old, decided literally 3 years ago that he was going to leave Dunkin' Donuts and Domino's with his wife and just figure it out, man. And it's interesting. You said something earlier. It's like, you just have to take the time to learn, but it's like taking the time to learn and then put it into action and stop fearing it. And I think it was, people can revert back to it, but that quote from the Rich Dad Poor Dad cash flow quadrant, it's so relatable. And it's just, you're trading time for money and just like how fast you want to do it. So once again, if you are interested in learning about Airbnb, make sure to check out Michael's course. I believe we're going to offer a little bit of a discount for our listeners.
Yeah. I'm happy to offer 15% off the course for anybody. And we'll talk offline. I'll get you guys a discount code. And I don't know if you want to do show notes or Instagram, whatever you want to do. 15% off for all you guys. And if you ever want to reach out on Instagram, shoot me a message. Love to hear from folks. I try to respond to a lot of people, especially if it's like a genuine question, not like a, hey, teach me Airbnb type of thing.
We get those too. Try to talk to everybody, but sometimes you gotta direct the question. But anyway, man, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for sharing your story with us. We had a blast.
Yeah, thanks guys. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Thanks so much. Thanks for tuning in this week. If you enjoyed the show and like what you heard, please subscribe, share with friends, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. The more ratings we get, the more eyes we'll get on our show, and in turn, we'll be able to provide you all with high-quality guests. It's simple. Open your podcast app, type in our podcast name, The Weekly Juice, click on reviews, and let us know what you think. Thanks so much, and see you next week.